part in our community, WGXC is playing its part by giving the community a voice. It's a unique open door to diversity, creative voices. Where else can you get local headlines and school closing, participating in on-air dialogue with your neighbors about an important issue? Hear radio artists sculpt with the airwaves, listening to Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! Live. So we really stretching it when we as a community radio and as a community where everybody has a voice. And the voice, you don't need to be
Malcolm Ross of Orange Juice, and you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC Accra.
You can find out about so many local events, like the traditional Irish music session. Every Sunday, there's an open Irish music jam at the Shamrock House in East Durham from 2 to 5 p.m. Find out more on the WGXC community calendar online at WGXC.org and add your own event to the WGXC community calendar and have it read on the radio at 90.7 FM by going to WGXC.org and clicking on the community calendar.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by SunCommon, supporting vibrant communities across New York for 15 years, offering custom solar installations for homes, farms, and businesses. Information at suncommon.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Marcus DeGrazia Acupuncture of Austerlitz, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to WGXC.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
Let's begin.
You have 5 seconds. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Don't worry if you can't follow everything that is said. Now repeat.
You've tuned in to WGXC during our winter pledge drive. It's called Please Assist Us with Transmission. And we're asking for you to assist us in transmission any way you can. You can make a donation, pledge your support at WGXC.org/donate, or call 518-697-7400. Or you can apply to do your own show at WGXC.org. In addition, we need lots of folks to help out with our morning and afternoon news and information program. So if you have a special interest in films, in food, in the weather, in interviewing your friends and neighbors, if you're interested in politics or just helping out locally, email us at info@wgxc.org to assist us in transmission. Become part of the WGXC community broadcasting team at wgxc.org or make a donation at wgxc.org/donate or call 518-697-7400 to pledge your support during the Please Assist Us in Transmission pledge drive at WGXC.
Kimberly Irwin here, host of Race Talks on WGXC 90.7 FM. I'm here every third Tuesday of the month at 7 p.m., where we have the very necessary conversation on race and ethnicity.
Africa's Daughters of the Diaspora. We will have on several founding members. Currently, we have Pastor Kim Singletary as the founding member.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me and our other sister friends to share this time on your radio show, Race Talks. Very delighted to be here. And also, just for historical record, you launched Race Talks after having a successful appearance on my radio show.
That's true. Holler. We already started supporting one another.
Yes, you know, and so it's just really good to be in another branch of that work. So, I'm Reverend Kim Singletary, or Kim L. Singletary. I put the L in my correspondences and, you know, introductions of myself, because I am a fifth generation L. You have to get closer to me to know what the L stands for.
I'm not that close, so I'm going to have to come over.
But also, you know, for Black History Month, our ministry, Overcomer Ministries, we will be doing a book group, this title of My Grandmother's Hands. And so, you know, I wanted to point that out as we are recognizing both Black History and Women's History Month coming in a couple of weeks, that I am here on the shoulders of great-grandmother, grandmother, aunts, et cetera, and so forth. And I give honor to them. Africa's Daughters of Diaspora was something that kind of came to me from interaction with the Daughters of the American Revolution. At the same time, noticing what was going on in our community, the Black African American community in Columbia County in particular, elsewhere in general, the disconnect between the generations, the loss of impact and influence with our younger people, and a disconnect with the pride that I feel in the ancestry of my parents and my ancestral parents and our ancestral parents as people in a foreign land. And so I had this interaction with the Daughters of the American Revolution, and I was like, they're so proud that they are Daughters of the American Revolution. It was, you know, late in the last century that they even allowed and acknowledged that there were Black people who fought in the American Revolution, and that they had daughters and granddaughters, that they opened up the doors of their organization to the descendants of Black people who had fought in the Revolution. But, and on top of that, you know, sort of as a side note or a footnote to our American Revolution story, we learned about Crispus Attucks very quickly and, you know, minutely, that he was the first person to fall in that battle, you know. So they had pride in that. And I just sensed, and at first I thought it was like the Daughters of Former Slaves. But, you know, when I convened our sisters together and we talked further about what we wanted to accomplish, we evolved to the name Africa's Daughters of the Diaspora. And after several meetings and months of meetings, we sort of arrived at this mission statement that said, we are a strong and noble people, and our ancestors were instrumental in building nations, economies, institutions, and winning wars. As Daughters of the African Diaspora, we celebrate our ancestors and the legacy they have collectively passed down from generation to generation. We exist to educate and elevate African diaspora women, girls, and families by continuing the work of helping and healing our hurting community through education and generational empowerment. And we want to celebrate, educate, and elevate, you know, women and girls, the Black African diasporic experience, and also our families and our brothers and sons and fathers. One of the things that, you know, we strive to do with Africa's Daughters of Diaspora is to break down the barriers that were erected so that we have colorism, we have nationalism, I'm from Brazil, or I'm from Jamaica, or I'm from Barbados, or I'm from, you know, the South, and all of these things that seek to divide us from understanding that it doesn't matter where the boat landed, we all come from the same ancestral line. And so so that's Africa's Daughters Diaspora's, you know, genesis. And we're still in the state of evolution. Some of the women that I invited to the conversation in organizing it are very involved in other areas. Sister Elena Mosley, who has Kuomba Drum and Dance, and she does the annual Kwanzaa Festival. a senior moment there. She does the annual Kwanzaa Festival. Sister Roxanne Wilkins and her daughter Tanya Jackson, they do the, they've started, I think simultaneously or not shortly thereafter, the Juneteenth celebration here in Hudson, as well as Mbantu, I think it's the name, their cultural center that they're developing and the work that they're doing there. So several of our, and then of course, you're an author, you have your own business and et cetera and so forth. So I realize now that, you know, in the founding, we kind of brought together people that we knew and people that we knew had a similar love and affinity and affection towards our ancestral legacy. But I did not consider how much they would be able or willing to invest of themselves in furthering, you know, the mission. So we've done some wonderful things. We've been a little bit at a stall, but I'm seeking God for how to correct our course so that we can not let, you know, Black History Month go by or Women's History Month go by without really using that as an opportunity to further our mission and also expand our reach. So,
again, to have a group of women coming together, it's dynamic, especially in a smaller community. This group is definitely one for leadership and to help people engage. I think that's one of the things that I want to make sure we share on this program is that we are looking to have membership, more people engaged, more people who would like to see themselves as a leadership role within either education, the political system, whatever walk of life there are, just in general motherhood. If you have, you know, you just love raising your children and you have really great ideas and support systems to do that, that's something that you can certainly share with others. You mentioned Crispus Attucks, and I looked him up, not because I didn't know who he was, but because I think many people don't. And when I was growing up, we didn't hear about African Americans playing a role other than them being enslaved. And that was maybe a sentence or two about the disposition of these other people, not quite Americans. And because we weren't named very much, there's probably five names of that I could recall in the civil rights movement that were given any kind of stature. I want to talk about what's happening now with the AP College Board. That's a group that actually administers credit for high school students to receive college credit. And right now they wonderfully introduced an African American studies course for students to gain college credit for their high school course. So having an African American studies course available for students to be able then to get credit, I think that's amazing. However, it's a big political issue now because there is a governor in Florida who has stated that there's certain readings and certain type of
topics that should not be on this AP, in this AP curriculum. And because he's a governor, not an educator, the fact that he was able to come in and make changes while the African American Studies course is in its transition stage made a lot of people raise their eyes. And in fact, just last week, I believe, another reverend started marching in Florida to the Capitol, to the state Capitol, to bring attention and awareness to the fact that white men should not be the ones making decisions on what constitutes as a good curriculum for an African American Studies course. Mm-hmm. And so clearly Crispus Attucks would probably be in that course as a historical, as the first person who was killed during the revolution. And that's not something that's hearsay. That's in biography.com. That's in our government records. So that is on the book, so to speak. And a lot of the things that are on the books, like that, which they want to take away, like the Black Lives Matter movement, which is currently happening today, is a little stunning. So I just want you to share what your feelings are about that. In fact, with another reverend taking the role, and in Florida, in fact, a lot of the reverends got together to make that stand. And I think that's kind of what Africans' daughters do here. They look at leadership within the religious community because that's where we have strong voices.
Yes, we do have in our founding founders table two other reverends, a retired pastor, Pastor Iris Waddell, who has advanced level education, and also a Reverend Dr. Denise Lawrence, who also, you know, is part of our founders table, though she lives in Baltimore. I mean, not Baltimore. Where does she live? I was just there.
Amen. She lives in a beautiful home. I just have to say she emailed me saying she might be able to come on. So we're hoping.
She does live, yeah, she does live in Maryland. You know, so we do have people who are involved with Africa's Daughters Diaspora who are not local to our county as well. Just want to put that out there because, as you said, we are looking for expansion. But I was taught about Crispus Attucks in elementary school.
Oh, okay.
It was very brief. It was minute. It was that he was a Black man and the first person to die in the American Revolution. And then, as I recall it, our education shifted from there to slavery. And that we were, you know, Black people were slaves in America, brought over from Africa, and President Abraham Lincoln emancipated the slaves, you know. So the whole history in between Crispus Attucks, or before Crispus Attucks, really, and is not really dealt with in the studies that, you know, I was receiving. And then, you know, when the civil rights of 69, you know, some people say that's when we really became free in America, in 1969, with the passage of, you know, the passage of the last, I guess, last round of civil rights bills, the housing bill. Prior to that, we had the education. Prior to that, we had voting, you know, and then they, you know, they dealt with housing and discrimination in housing. So, you know, it was separate but equal, all that had gotten, you know, squashed, so to speak. But so then, you know, we jump into the civil rights movement in history, and all that happened in between emancipation and civil rights was not dealt with, you know, in terms of education. So for me, Black history is American history, and it should be taught as such. I don't think it should just be an advanced placement class. I think it should be taught. There are some educators who take that position and integrate Black history into their studies, 365 or however long the school year is. Snaps and claps, congratulations to them. But it becomes their own initiative, their own, you know, undertaking, rather than part of the educational system, the Board of Education, requiring that it be taught as such, the history of America. So having that deficit in our history required, necessitated that we have Black History Studies, Black History Month, you know, Black History APs. But I think the goal is really not to just have Black history education. I think it's to be part of American history and told in fullness, just like, you know, for the indigenous people, their history to be more than, you know, Pocahontas and John Smith, you know, I mean.
Well, I want to say also that Christmas Addict's mother is an indigenous woman. Mm-hmm. I wanted to put that out there so that, yes, you know, and we, because you had mentioned earlier when you were talking about ADD and how it's, how you, you know, you started to think about having it, was that, you know, we look at ourselves as different nations as opposed to looking at ourselves as one nation. And so I think it's interesting that we don't talk about all of our dynamics. And now that we can with a gene, you know, all these gene DNA companies and the PBS network series where, you know, we are seeing that we're 6 degrees separation from many different people who don't necessarily look like us with our skin tones or our structures, our physical structures. So, yeah, I think that's really interesting to know that. I'm sure you weren't told that, though, but that he was Native American also.
Yeah, no, I did know that. Yes.
You didn't know that too?
Oh, no, I didn't learn that in school. No, I learned that. Yeah, like you said, I learned that later, much later. Right. Yeah.
And they whitewashed Native Americans' contributions also.
Well, you know, unfortunately, and, you know, I'm not judging or bashing people who are lovers of Westerns. I like my Westerns. My mom loves Westerns. Whenever she's around or I'm visiting her, we're watching Westerns together. But then to know that our racism in this nation was so powerful, even during the age of television in the 60s, 50s, and 60s, and into, you know, like I said, till civil rights, you know, happened in 69, where the doors of opportunity opened up for more and all people, they wouldn't even hire indigenous actors. They would
yeah, wow. They,
you know, colorize white people to look like Native Americans. And so, you know, we just have a lot of issues in our nation that we have to address. You know, if you go to therapy or psychiatry, you know, they want to help you find out the root causes of the issues that you're dealing with. You know, some of our issues are not the problem, they're symptoms of a deeper problem. And so, yeah, I would like to see, you know, there's a really good, I think it just began because I only saw one episode last night. So I'm hoping that it's going to have more episodes soon. I have streaming television and it's something that Spectrum, I don't know if it's Spectrum put it out or if the name of it's called Spectrum, but it's, I'm going to subtitle it Living Black In.
Hmm.
Title is something like that. Last night it was about living Black in India. What's the experience of Black in India? They're going to do Korea. They're going to do Japan. You know, they showed these previews of having these conversations with Black people who live in these various countries. And so.
Now, when you say Black people, you mean African Americans, Black people in America, or Americans travel, or Black people of the diaspora?
Black people of the African diaspora, some in, like in an instance in India, there were slaves brought over to India and they live still in the forest. They don't really engage with the Indian population. They live in a forest. I forget the name of the particular group. It's Sinchi, something like that. But, and so there's this young man, he's a therapist. You know, he left the forest, went out to have education in the wider population, went to, you know, advanced education and got his degrees, and he's a therapist. And then there's, so he's ancestrally Indian, you know, from going back to slavery in India. Then you have some who were brought there in their early childhood. Their father, in most of those instances, was married to an Indian woman. They met in Africa somewhere, and then they came to live in India, and they were raised in India from their earliest childhood years. And there may have been one, I think there was one who would come from that kind of relationship, who was born in India. So so for, you know, for them, India is by and large their country of origin, their country, and their Black people there. And so when you listen to their experience, it mirrors our experience in so many ways, you know, in the United States. The difference being that their population is so minuscule in a country of billions, and there's about 60,000 of them, you know.
Wow.
So, you know, their ability to fight the powers that be, per se, you know, are different than what we have here. But so they're going to do Japan similarly, and Korea, because, you know, there were service people who fought in the wars and married Japanese women, or, you know, went to work for companies and, you know, and married over there, or, you know, were transferred over there with their families to work, and those experiences as well. So, as you know, so as you said, you know, we are in this point now, place now, where because of technology, you know, TV and internet and air travel, you know, the borders are, for Black people, are not as fixed as they were. We can interact more with each other, see that we have more in common than not, and that our legacy, our ancestral legacy, goes back to another country, which is Africa, you know. And, you know, when we talk about Italians or Chinese or Japanese or whatever, and they look to their, you know, where they've migrated to or immigrated to or whatever, they still know that their root is Japanese or Chinese or Italian or whatever. And for us to recognize that our root is Africa, you know, and so.
I really like the fact that you mentioned that the roots are in Africa, because that's true. And when we look at Black History Month in America, we also have to, or we don't have to, but we can and should look to see about the engagement of current Africans in America, because there are actually people who were born and raised in Africa, because Africa is a huge continent, right? Mm-hmm. And but by reasons of war or some other desperate type times in their countries, their native lands, they come here as refugees or immigrants and remain. And I believe it's because of the African American experience, which I labeled after traditional African Americans, that what those that came maybe to the United States from Africa in chains or enslaved, and then the history of our fight, of our strength, of our determination to come to where we are now, so that we are now represented on TV. We are represented in many of all facets of American or Western American life, which still doesn't hold true quite so much for those of the indigenous people or Asian Americans, or even Latin Americans, where they're blended in so much. Just today, I know that I didn't want to get too much in politics, and we're running out of the first time period that I've stated for, or set aside for ADD. But I just wanted to bring in the fact that there is one mayor from Liberia. Well, he was born in Liberia, and now he's the first African American mayor of the state of Montana.
Wow.
I have his name. I might have, I'm going to take a little bit to find that, but and it's of the really, I'm thinking, okay, so it must be a really tiny city, right? But no, he is, I'm scanning my notes right now. I have so many notes for this show. I know I'm not going to be able to, we're not going to be able to get it all in. Okay, so he's the mayor of Helena, and it's Mayor Wilmot Collins, who fled his civil war in Liberia. So they had asked him a little bit about his experience in a war-torn country, or a country that was, you know, going through a civil war so recently, and how did our engagement with each other on the steps of the Capitol on January 6th make him feel? And he was like, one of the things he said is, I knew you guys wouldn't like it. Don't do that. You know, you don't want that to happen. And then they asked him, you know, how did you think to run for office? Even you're not even, you know, an American from, you know, birth. And he was like, well, my friends, my family, they started talking to me about it, and I thought, I know people, I'll try. And he knocked on doors. He did the regular thing that one does when one is unknown, to try to be elected, and he was elected. So I think through the toils of our situation in America, and I think also, and I know that we haven't really talked about it, some of the other ADD founders didn't come on or haven't been on yet. So, but I think it's because of our strength in numbers brought together by our religious beliefs that stemmed from being an enslaved group. All we had to do, or where we had to, all we had to go to for convening was, you know, under the umbrella of the church.
Well, you know, I want to back up a little bit and say that I make the distinction of Black African Americans, because there are so many people who migrate from Africa who are not Black, and they are African Americans too, you know, but they have a different experience. Also to say that, yes, people have come to from Africa as refugees or you know, immigrated looking for a better life, but in a lot of instances, they also came for work opportunities or, you know, advanced degree studies. And so anyway, you know, we are here. And that's also what Ed thought to do, seeks to do, because I know, not so much here living in Columbia County now for a few decades, but I do have a lot of interaction back in the city, and I grew up in the city. And, you know, populations from all around the world are much larger and more concentrated. And there was this ethos, you know, Africans from Africa, Black Africans from Africa, you know, were better than, you know, Black African Americans. And, you know, people from the Caribbean, you know, were better than Black African Americans, and et cetera and so forth. And that was perpetuated by a system that sought to have us divided. And it's still very effective. It's still very effective in our community. So what we want to do, and what other groups are doing, is dealing with that, you know, and working very hard not to fall into that.
Can you explain that a little bit? Because like I said, in my book, oh, you know what? I'm going to ask that we stop here, and we'll pick it up on the other end with traditional African Americans, because I want to do a note for WGXC for our pledge drive. Call 518-697-7400 or go online, wgxc.org/donate. By giving just 17 cents a day, you can pave the way to keeping shows like mine, Race Talks, on air. Excellent. So we're back. And again, it's so great to be able to have this conversation on WGXC 90.7 FM. And we, for those of you who would like to donate, we will have another opportunity at the end of this segment. But let's get back in. I just wanted to see if we were talking about the same thing, because you qualified the differences between those who are of from an African nation, born and raised from there, and as opposed to those of us who are from the African diaspora, because our history is from the legacy of being enslaved in America. And so for me, I kind of give the term traditional African Americans so that people can know the difference, because of the difference in our upbringing. And I think it's relevant because, of course, the difference between being an immigrant in any country and being first generation, second generation, or having your cultural norms or understanding all from one nation makes a difference in how we perceive ourselves and our cultural identity going forth. So I think it's important. So is that what I was hearing that you were saying, that you saw these differences too? You just didn't really provide a name to it, or did you give a name to it?
Well, the name I gave to it was Black African American. You know, if you're African in America and you're Black African American. If you were immigrated from the Caribbean, Brazil, you know, the UK, and you're Black in America and you have citizenship or dual citizenship, you're Black African American. You know, that's how it is for me, you know.
Oh, so for you, there's no distinction.
I'm working, my message is that we drop the distinctions. My work is that the distinctions are the work of the white patriarchal society that, you know, wants to keep us, like on the plantation, separated. You couldn't speak your language, you couldn't speak, you know, use your traditions, because they wanted you to be separate, you know.
As you referenced, there are people who are Black in Korea and other nations that we really don't hear too much about or see or recognize them as being such. But like in our country, we decide where the money goes by what your ethnic background is. And they have the box, check your race, right? Check, are you white? In fact, they have something really insane, which is you have to check whether you are Hispanic or Latino. And then there's a question on your race. So are you white, Hispanic, Latino, or are you Black, Hispanic, or Latino? I mean, they want you to break it down, and that's for the only group that you break it down for.
Right.
So it's, and then there's mixed, and then there's, and then I was privy to a National Action Network conference that they hold every year in New York City, where one speaker, and I'm sorry, I can't recall the name of the speaker, but made a mention that we check the box because that's where the America decides to give the funding. So
I think that's bogus, because, you know, we check the box, we have, you know, Brooklyn, you know, 60% Black or whatever, and then they have poor schools, dilapidated building, you know, all these things, but the resources are supposed to go there because we check the box. I think that's a bogus. I think that's just something that they use. If there is a need for more money in education, it shouldn't matter if you're Black, white, brown, or yellow.
Absolutely.
Send the money to that area. If there's need for more hospitals, if there's need for more infrastructure work, then do the work. You don't have to check those boxes. It's, again, to just keep us in this hierarchy. And, you know, so I'll argue that till the cows come home. They can't convince me. But you know what I do? I put in human race. I don't check the boxes. I got another message. Just put down there human race.
I love that. You know, I love it. One race, the human race.
They want to know how many Black people in America. They've got drones up there. They can tell you how many, okay? They got supercomputers. They know how many, you know? But praise the Lord.
Well, I see we have another visitor, and I want to recognize our other visitor. Introduce yourself, share maybe what your outreach, what you want your outreach to be, and a little bit of your ministry. Also.
Okay. I'm Dr. Denise Parker Lawrence. I currently serve as an associate minister at Kingdom Fellowship AME Church in Calverton, Maryland. I'm a recent transplant. My home is New York, will always be my home, and my home church, the Greater Allen Cathedral, which I worked as the director of an abstinence program in New York. I'm currently the director of the Thrive Ministry, which is for 55 plus population, and we are thriving. We are helping us to understand that even in our latter years, our former years will be greater than our latter years will be greater than our former years. So I thank God for this opportunity. African Daughters of the Diaspora has meant so much to me because it's important that we know our heritage. It's important that we know from whence we've come. It's important also that we understand the value and the importance of community and having our sisters walk beside us. Each of us in our different facets of life, whether it's ministry, work, home, we have different challenges that we go through. I am a hospice chaplain by trade. So a part of what I am able to provide is comfort care. And African Daughters of the Diaspora has provided that comfort, knowledge, information, empowerment, enabling, and to let us know that whatever it is that we're dealing with, we do not deal with it alone. So it's been an awesome ministry. I've been under the tutelage of Reverend Kim for almost 40 years now, and I thank God for her obedience. You know, sometimes it may feel challenging and you may question, you know, what am I doing? Am I supposed to be doing this? And I thank God that she inclines her ear to hear from God, regardless of what it may look like, that she walks by faith and not by sight. And I thank God that she meets the challenges and recognizes that what she's doing is for the service of the Lord. It becomes her story, but his glory. And we become the benefactors and the beneficiaries by aligning ourselves alongside. I thank God for having this opportunity to meet Dr. Kimberly through these last couple of years and being able to walk with her and her as a visionary as well. So I'm grateful to be here today. When I came in, you were talking a little bit about the demographics, and I just want to say this, that I became very perplexed with these boxes, and particularly when it got to nationality, because I'm like, well, what is the nationality? You know, race I have, gender I have, even, you know, geographic, demographic, but what's the nationality? You know, so that I found very perplexing with these census tract boxes.
You know, and I just also want to say, you know, when persons are from Italy, they don't say, you know, are you from Naples? Are you from, you know, some other
Bologna?
Yeah, it comes down to Black and brown people, you know, that is so important and so necessary to know, you know. So
I know that we don't want to check a box, but I do want to know, because I think, like you said, Reverend Denise, history is important. So can both of you, and let's start with Pastor or Reverend Singletary, because she was on first, and it gives you a little bit of a moment to think about it, Reverend Denise. Do you recall knowing when you were a color?
Yeah, so I grew up in Brownsville in Brooklyn, and everybody in our immediate vicinity were Black, except for the store owners. So, you know, so I knew there were different colors that existed. You know, I did not know that it was going to be a lifelong journey for equality, equity, opportunity, you know, respectability, you know. Wow. But I do know that there was a white man, he had a butcher shop across the street, and there was a white family, I guess it was the family business, that had the store on the corner, you know, on the other block across the street. And but I then was invited, I was invited by some teachers who wanted to get me out of the school to be bused to school. And that was my first experience of racism. And as a 9-year-old being bused to school in Bensonhurst. And that's when I knew, you know, a parent came up to school. I was called to the principal's office, and the mom and her little blonde hair, blue eyed girl, Hillary, were sitting in the principal's office, and I was called in because Hillary was afraid of me. And so, yeah.
So that was what age again?
9.
9. Wow. Let me ask you this. So your community, other than the store owners, the business people there, were Black?
Yes.
Because there was a story, I think it was, oh God, I want to say it was, I'm forgetting his name, but he said he didn't see or know of any white people, never saw a white person a day in his life until he was 9.
Mm-hmm. Well, if it weren't for those business owners, I would not have either.
Well, maybe, yeah, because there was TV at the time, so I guess he meant in real life, yeah. Interesting, because we were talking about Westerns, so we certainly would have seen them on television, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I saw them on television. And I thought that life was available to me.
Oh, well,
so,
yeah.
So when they said, do you want to be bused to school? I said, yeah. Yeah. So I didn't know that they were trying to, you know, adhere to the law. Go ahead, Reverend.
So like Reverend Kim, I grew up in East New York, Brooklyn. And I have to really say, when I look back in hindsight, it was kind of a Camelot experience. I would say it was primarily 60 to 70% Black. We had Mr. Louis, the Jewish guy on the corner. And I'm going to really date myself. So he had a book for each of the families. And you would go in, the children during the week would go in and shop and get whatever they were going to get, milk, bread, peas, or whatever. And he would write it down in his pad. And on Fridays, when the parents got paid, they would go and clean and clear up the book for Mr. Louis. So I remember that distinctly, very personal relationship. Then on the other corner was the Italian baker. And across the street from that was the deli, where you would get egg creams. You would have the countertops. And that was a white-owned established business as well. So I grew up
at... Oh, dear. Her signal.
A very mixed community. So had an appreciation. But then you began to have white flight. And the white families left. And then you ended up dealing with issues of poverty and all that that entailed. And by that time, we moved on to, we moved to Queens, from Brooklyn to Queens. So yes, I do remember the time of being colored Negro. And that was the time of James Brown. Say it loud. I'm black and I'm proud. And my godmother on my mother's side, that family came from North Carolina. And she was a very dark-skinned woman. Loved me like I don't know what. The greatest love ever. She refused to be called Black. She was allowed herself to be called Negro because that's what she was raised with. She refused to be allowed to call Black. And remember, that's when the Afro came out too. So people stopped straightening their hair and allowed more of their natural hair or the Afro to come on. So that, as a young girl, I remember how that impacted her. Switching. And in a lot of communities where I teach, particularly of Caucasian communities, I talk about that track of being colored, you know, nigger, colored, Black, African American to Black.
Afro-American. Had a
Afro-American. And then the piece with the Afro-American, which I learned later, probably in college, is that whole debate from Africans resenting that African-Americans were calling themselves African-Americans because they didn't come from Africa. They didn't come from Africa. So that became another distinction. And then I married into a Caribbean-American family. So then that became another distinction. So we have had all these distinctions within our family line. And the last piece I'll say is about colorism. So my father's side of the family came from the Virginias, where you have what was called the Blue Vein Society and the Brown Paper Bag Test. Yes. And in that Brown Paper Bag Test is you weren't supposed to marry anybody that was darker than that brown paper bag. And the Blue Vein Society was you weren't supposed to marry anybody that you couldn't see their veins. So that became another level of distinguishing and distincting ourselves one from another. So I remember all of those very distinctly.
Wow, I heard of the brown paper bag test when I was in college at Spelman, because my boyfriend at the time, who went to Morehouse, his father, who served in the military, was very, 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 very light. I say that because when he goes up to the table to join, he checks the box, check one, he checks the box, Black. But when they start giving him his orders of where he's going to stand to go with his group, they put him with the white group. And he sees the difference and says, oh, no. There's like, hey, look, and it wasn't a nice conversation or a nice talk. He was like, look, I can't have someone that looks like you in with that group. I don't care what you say you are, that's where you go or you don't go. Mm-hmm. So he went with the white group. Imagine that conundrum, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. His mom, when I met his mom and dad, they came to meet me because they were from Louisiana. And little did I know, I did not pass the brown paper bag test.
Mm-hmm.
And she wasn't happy about that, but she tried to play it off. But his father, who was even still blue-eyed, looking very much like he was of a white ancestry, didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really interesting how we culturally get there, right? And I think that's why I asked the question, when did you know you were a color? Because I think that ideology is something that sticks with us, like you were saying, you since we were children. And how then do we overcome that and maybe join a society or a group or an organization that then can advocate for other young people not having to go through that, especially at a time when Instagram, everything is so visual, and there's studies that are being done now that show that 30% of our young people, and it doesn't matter what community you are in, what kind of wealth status your family is in, that 30 or your identity, your ethnic identity, but 30% of our children, our girls. Actually, specifically, our girls are saying that they have thoughts of doing harm to themselves.
Right. Right. Because they, aesthetically, they don't measure up to the standard of beauty that the society is putting out there, you know. And I know, just go back for a minute to my childhood experiences. You know, as I became an adult, as I became a pastor, as I came into Columbia County, 30 plus years ago, and my first experience here was that the 60s hadn't happened, so advocating for families, advocating at the school district level, advocating in the courthouse, advocating for, promotions for people, advocating for return of deposits on their rent from landlords who were trying to disenfranchise them, and have that happen to myself as well. You know, being at 9 and 10 and 11, the only Black in the room, you know, served me. And there are people, you know, that 20, 25 years our junior who, you know, don't have that experience. You know, they have a one person, two people, three people they can get together and go into a room and talk, you know. And thank God for that, you know, thank God for that. But, you know, I think it was a preparation for me to be able to go and speak to the district attorney on behalf of somebody or a judge on behalf of somebody, you know, because I had been the only person in the room at the age of 9. and I had to also, you know, learn how to navigate, you know, in a room where people automatically didn't like me, you know, were afraid of me, you know, just for my being, you know, just for my being and being there. So it ended up serving me, you know, and it still has to serve me, you know, it still has to serve me. So, yeah.
Well, I think this is a really great conversation that would be one to open up for members to find out, specifically those who want to engage with Africa's Daughters of the Diaspora, because that kind of can field what we do next. You know, how does our organization look? What maybe committees that we could have to help our girls or and their upbringing and getting to the point where they can advocate on their own behalf, because not everyone's always going to be there for them. We had another member, Tanya Jackson, who seemed to have come on and popped off. So I want to maybe stay on just a few more minutes longer, if you don't mind, Reverend Kim, because she might pop back on. And then we could have at least another member who is a little bit younger than both of us, although I like
I'm
the
here.
Fact. Oh, good, great. I just want to say, I like the fact that Africa's Daughters of the Diaspora has a membership of all ages, but we don't get too young. What's the youngest that we are now?
We haven't done that demographic, actually. I know that in one of our, maybe one or two of our monthly conversations where we've had guest speakers, we've had people who are just out of college on with their mothers or their grandmothers, and but we haven't, you know, been able to really tap into that. And I think, again, it's because, you know, some of the people that are a part of the founders table have other commitments and obligations that sort of like distracted from, you know, developing that. When we were talking about ADD in the beginning, and I was saying how we kind of stalled right now, it skipped over what Reverend Dr. Denise was sharing about, you know, how it has served her and served others in the community. When we were, you know, inviting people by Zoom, you know, and during the course of the pandemic, you know, height of the isolation or social distancing, you know, so we have been doing some things, and, you know, and that's been good. But one of the things we do want to, you know, focus on as part of our mission statement is, you know, celebrating, elevating, and educating our young women. And before I relinquish the line to Tanya, I also want to say that I took advantage of that opportunity with my earlier Tuesday afternoon show, our Around the Table Talk, that we introduced a teen girl segment, and it's called Chick Chat. And we have tweens and teens who run this, you know, this 20-minute segment. And so that their voices are heard and they begin to understand that their opinions are important, their presence is important, and you know, and we want to hear from them. So, you know, that's something that, you know, that I get to do, but, you know, it's not through ADD per se.
Well, I know I'm going to get you on, Tanya. I'm just thinking, and Tanya, maybe you could introduce yourself to Race Talks listeners earlier that you can be in Korea, you can be in Sweden, you could be anywhere and still be of the diaspora. So info@africasdaughters.org. That's how you can inquire and get information on membership. Tanya Jackson, Ms. Tanya Jackson, we mentioned some of what you do in the community, but please introduce yourself to the audience.
I'm Tanya Jackson, member of ADD,